This part of the Scott Horton Show is sponsored by Audible.com. And right now, if you go to audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, you can get your first audiobook for free. Of course, I'm recommending Michael Swanson's book, The War State, The Cold War Origins of the Military-Industrial Complex and the Power Elite. Maybe you've already bought The War State in paperback, but you just can't find the time to read it. Well, now you can listen while you're out marching around. Get the free audiobook of The War State by Michael Swanson, produced by Listen and Think Audio, at audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, y'all, Scott Horton Show. Check out the archives at scotthorton.org and at libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Okay, introducing Samuel Oakford. He formerly was the UN correspondent for Vice, and now he is with Chris Woods at airwars.org. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Samuel?
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me on. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us here. So for the people, go ahead and just tell us first and foremost here what Air Wars is, if they've never heard of it.
Sure. So Air Wars is a monitoring transparency organization. I work as kind of the in-house investigative journalist looking into reports that our teams are monitoring in Iraq and Syria. We focus on foreign airstrikes. So that means, the U.S. coalition, but also Russia. We have watched these reports from the ground for, since this began in 2014, and have come up with estimates of how many civilians likely were killed during that time each month. And those estimates are far higher than either the U.S. coalition or Russia, which claims it, doesn't kill anyone, have admitted to.
Yeah. Well, in that interesting parallel, how both of them are perfectly willing to lie and just the same lie and just as credibly as each other, too. Who, us? Well, yes, we do drop high explosives from the air, but we only ever hit the people that we're trying to hit. And those guys are always only very guilty militant fighters. Yeah. Who could possibly believe that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's important to draw a distinction between the coalition and Russia. I mean, you can talk at a higher level about why the coalition is doing what it's doing. Russia, there's been a clear pattern that they've targeted, civilian sites, hospitals, things like this. We actually have so many cases that we're still going through them, going back many months, because the sheer intensity and brutality of their campaign was, kind of unparalleled in recent years. The coalition, for its part, we estimate they likely have killed more than 2,500 civilians in both countries since 2014. They do admit to some civilian casualties. They've, if my numbers are the latest numbers, are about 199, and those are all American CivCas. So there's other members of this coalition, but somehow they don't seem to be killing anyone, you're talking about France, the UK, Australia, some Arab partners, and that's not very believable. That seems like a statistical impossibility. The US does admit, though, to some strikes. They've opened up in recent months to more outside reporting, which is a positive thing, but they still fall far, far, far short of what it seems, based on our monitoring, is happening. They don't admit to that.
Mm-hmm. So the 2,500 number, that's total number killed, including fighters by Americans, in what time period?
That's only civilians, and that's an estimate.
Oh, that's only
based
civilians.
On our best.
I see. Yeah, that's y'all's estimate compared to their 200.
Yeah, they're right around 200.
And over what time period you're talking? The whole time?
That's since 2014. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I won't venture to. I mean, I don't think outside of intelligence agencies, people are even making assessments of how many fighters have been killed and things like that. But when there are civilian casualty reports on the ground, you can get at this stuff. It exists on social media, so you have to speak Arabic. We have some great researchers that work on Iraq and Syria specifically that go through social media looking for reports. People write, a Facebook message when their family member is killed in an airstrike or another form of violence. Check that against other local media, because this is generally not really covered, and especially not with any kind of granularity in the international press. So that's what we do.
Yeah. Well, so this is a bit reminiscent of Iraq Body Count and the work that they would try to do. Also, getting as many media reports as they could and compiling them and still counting on a one-by-one basis. And, of course, they were long criticized for, I guess, sort of framing it like these are definitely the only casualties or something along those lines, and sort of served as a lowest level estimate of people dying in that war. But so I wonder whether you guys have sort of an estimation of, you know, the deaths that you just can't ever be made aware of that must be out there somewhere. In other words, like a separate number for these are the ones we can prove and these are the ones that we have, you know, moderate evidence. And these are the, you know, overall, we think probably the number is more like this, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's impossible to have, you know, an exact estimate given the lack of investigations on the part of the belligerents here. And also a lot of this is happening in ISIS controlled territory where they will, you know, kill people if they so much as use a phone, let alone whether they're using that to disseminate reporting. You know, we have a grading system, and we go through every month. I mean, actually on a daily basis, and grade strikes and gather the reports of that describe those strikes. If there's only one that's a poorly graded, attribution, so we can't say with certainty for sure in that case that there is. You know, that's a clear-cut case where it's probably been a coalition strike or a Russian strike, if that's the case. For instance, in January, we came up with 95 alleged civilian casualty incidents, which was a big increase. That was also the first month that coalition deaths attributed to the coalition surpassed Russia. So that's Iraq and Syria compared to the Russians in just Syria. So that was over 600. There were over 600 alleged deaths in those incidents we tracked, but that's before we vet. And the vetting is the most important part of this process. And we ultimately came up with at least 254 or around there. So that might give you a sense of how this process works. And we think that those baseline numbers are really what's important.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I got to say, you know, these are pretty low numbers for a war. Depending on the context, I'm not saying I'm in favor of any intervention over there at all, or I'm trying to apologize for any of it or whatever, but I guess I could see how people would say that, well, geez, you know, here we have an entire state that was really just run by Al-Qaeda in Iraq, a bunch of right-wing militia kooks, more or less, over there, right? And why can the superpower and its allied Peshmerga and Shiite army and militias not get rid of these guys, and including, for that matter, the Kurdish fighters fighting them with embedded American special forces and Air Force support in Syria as well, got them surrounded by our friends on all sides, and yet they declared their state in 2014, and we're still not done rousting them out of Mosul and Raqqa. And there are some who argue that they're not even really trying. If they were really trying, this thing would have been over a long time ago, and yeah, there probably would have been a lot more civilian deaths than this, but you kind of got to wonder who these F-18s are bombing all day. How many fixed positions of IS fighters can there possibly be out in the outskirts of Raqqa? You know, I just don't understand, honestly. Who are they bombing?
I think I'm not the best person to hypothesize about how quickly this could have been executed. I know that that ISIS is often uses, you know, I mean, this is a term that, you know, is used a lot and not necessarily in accurate ways, but they do use civilians to protect them. You know, they in Mosul right now, they're drilling holes through walls so they can use residential areas to move through, which obviously puts civilians in danger. I mean, there's many reasons why this has been particularly bad for civilians and why it's also hard to bomb if you're making any kind of effort not to kill civilians, which presumably, you know, the U.S. is to some extent. They have made some progress in pushing them back. There have been political complications, which we wrote about recently. And in Syria, obviously, Turkey has its own vested interests there, and they don't want the Kurds to be the force that is the ground force which takes Raqqa. So they've added some complications there, and that obviously will delay things potentially or have complicated them already. In Iraq, they, I mean, from my understanding is, you know, they're quite good fighters. And but beyond that, I wouldn't really venture, you know, to say why it's taken so long. Mm-hmm.
You drink coffee. I drink coffee. Just about everyone drinks coffee. So why bother with anything but the best? Darren's coffee is roasted at his new shop in Claremont, Indiana. And coming soon, you can order on Amazon and support the show by using Scott Horton's affiliate link. Darren'sCoffee.com. Because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
So it seems like there's kind of been a division of labor, right, where the Americans have been bombing the Islamic State in the east and the Russians have been bombing the al-Nusra Front in the west. But now that al-Nusra and their allies have lost East Aleppo, are the Russians now sharing airspace in eastern Syria with the Americans bombing the Islamic State? Or they're still focusing on targets in Idlib province and that kind of thing?
Well, it's definitely getting more complicated by the day, especially since Trump's inauguration with his somewhat ambiguous stance about how he'll handle sharing areas with Russians. If you look at it in Manbij right now, there's, you know, Russian and American troops just a very short distance from each other, and they're there for various reasons. In terms of bombing, the U.S. has a separate campaign. It's kind of kept apart. It's unilateral in the sense that it's not part of the coalition campaign, so it doesn't show up now in coalition strike reports, which are put out every day, and that's targeting what one could say are, you know, al-Qaeda-linked groups, and we've seen those strikes increase as well. So that there's definitely the potential for conflicting, whatever deconfliction resolves, there's potential for that there in the future. I just want to step back too and note that, you know, we've been monitoring this year. There's just been the last few months of last year were particularly deadly for civilians in Iraq and Syria, and that's only increased in the past few months. We've seen there's been reports of hundreds of civilians killed in the first week of March, just in Mosul. I think that it's kind of hard to wrap your head around. These are such densely, this is like, you know, very old city, the area that's called the old city around there. There was a report yesterday, I believe, in the Telegraph. One of the reporters actually managed to, you know, talk to folks who survived one of the recent onslaughts there or had family members that did, and they estimated, you know, 300 were killed in just two neighborhoods, which is, maybe it's not mind-boggling to everyone, but that should be alarming, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, for the last week straight, I don't know, maybe there's been an exception here or there, and maybe for longer, there have been stories on the front page of antiwar.com about civilians bombed in Mosul. Today it's 11. I think yesterday it was 20, and just on and on every day like that. So, and those are just maybe one story. That's just one bomb in one neighborhood and doesn't necessarily get to the others.
So, yeah, it's difficult to keep up with, and obviously it's awful for people on the ground, but for tracking purposes, the fog of war right now is it makes it difficult, and also the sheer intensity. You know, there's Apaches flying. I think a lot of people don't understand the full extent of the firepower being unleashed there. There's mm-hmm. a lot of artillery. There's Apache helicopters, and there are U.S. and also there are Iraqi Air Force flying, although it's less clear to us, at least, exactly where they're striking. Mm-hmm.
I sure hope I didn't sound like I was warmongering earlier. I was really just kind of puzzling over what are they doing? I mean, I'm trying to imagine an air war around the city of Raqqa where, you know, over all this time, a couple thousand people die over 2.5 years, but they're, you know, launching their jets all day, every day. It's some kind of make work program. I just don't know what they're accomplishing or who they're really targeting or what is going on. That's all. I didn't.
Yeah.
I only want to see the whole thing canceled. I didn't mean to just ask for a little consistency in the war or anything yeah. like that.
Yeah. But I mean, to your point, if a operation that will happen at some point is postponed for a long time while there is an air war going on, so they will be bombing during that time, that could, obviously, if you do the math, a certain number of civilians are killed during airstrikes, and airstrikes go on for a year before an operation starts, well, you're just going to have, more civilians needlessly killed. Mm-hmm. I think that's one way to look at it, although I won't speak to whether, why they've exactly delayed it, but that's happened.
Well, you mentioned the politics of the Turks there. I wonder about the politics of sending in the Marine Corps, not just special operations guys, but now the infantry, artillery, and I don't know, I guess guys in trucks with rifles. Is there a new deal with Assad to allow that, or they're just doing it? They got permission from the Kurds, from the YPG, and that's good enough? Do you know?
I wouldn't be the first to know whether they have a deal with Assad, but that would fulfill a lot of conspiracies, I'm sure.
but, I mean, it's either that or they've invaded his country, right?
Yeah,
I mean, the point of special operations forces is that they're deniable, even if they're really not. I mean, they sort of kind of are, but infantry's infantry, right? I mean, I'm not the legal expert, Scott Horton. That's the other guy, but you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, all I can say is in Mumbish, they are flying their flags quite high. So they're special operations, but they have huge American flags on their trucks. So I don't know if that's an oxymoron or what. But yeah, things are heating up around Raqqa. Raqqa's been bombed every day this year, just so unrelenting. A lot of this bombing is taking place in the outskirts in the countryside. So you'll see the same town show up over and over again. One of the worst strikes recently was just a bus or some large vehicle that could fit, a lot of people was hit by an airstrike, which, it seems likely it was a coalition strike, and it killed at least 14, some reports put it as high as 20. It's just driving, outside of one of these villages.
Mm-hmm. Hey, so let me ask you about Yemen for a minute here. It's right around the 2-year anniversary of America and Saudi and UAE's war against the Houthi Sala coalition there. And I know this is something that you wrote about for a long time. And the part I actually know quite a bit about the war itself, because I know a couple journalists inside Yemen that I've been talking to, or one in particular. But what I know less about is the various attempts at some kind of peaceful resolution to this problem. And efforts at the United Nations and in Kuwait, I know they've had a few meetings and this and that kind of thing. And I guess I'll go ahead and preface this too by saying I was talking with an expert the other day, Joost Hilterman. I'm not sure if you know him, but he'd written for Foreign Policy and clearly knows a whole lot about this. And I had floated this possibility, and he didn't say he thought this one really made much sense, but something along these lines. If Saleh is buddies with the Houthis now, well, then maybe we can just put him back in power, because the Saudis and the Americans both used to be happy to have him in there. And so why couldn't that be good enough for everybody at this point? And he was saying, well, not necessarily Saleh, but yeah, I mean, there could be somebody, not Hadi, who everyone could agree on. And that's obviously must be done here. The war's not getting anywhere. Hadi is never going to be the pseudo, quote unquote, president leader of Yemen ever again. So what are we doing here? Why are we still bombing this country? Is there even a plan? Is anybody even trying, or is the whole thing just on autopilot? We're just going to keep fighting for and against Al-Qaeda and for and against the Houthis at the same time for another 2 years, or what? Do you know?
I mean, I don't know. It's so difficult now, 2 years into this, to know what will play out. I don't think that reinstating Saleh is something that would, be morally acceptable to a lot of people, given how he ran the country and, stole money and so forth for so long. I think one way to look at this also is this was another situation that was handed off to the Trump administration, in a sense. Not that you can not blame the Trump administration for what it's continuing to do, and especially for to highlight the escalation against alleged al-Qaeda sites, which are unprecedented, the intensity of those strikes. And as you pointed out, there's two things going on here. There's the U.S. support for the war against the Houthis and their allies, and then also these al-Qaeda strikes. I think that Obama, I mean, late in his presidency, he finally decided not to pull some guidance systems, reportedly that they were going to sell. Trump has now apparently decided, or Tillerson has decided, that, you know, that sale will go through. A lot of people are making noise about that. You know, say what you will about that, but the overall support package was never in question, it seems. You know, so the U.S. is refueling planes every day. As far as I know, that's still happening. So, you know, the meat and potatoes here, I mean, the U.S. is supporting a war there. So I think people have lost that a lot with all the focus on the special ops raid. I really haven't seen nothing about the actual U.S. Military campaign there that exists in parallel.
Yeah. Well, you know, I guess a lot of us, I'll say us because including me, I don't know about you, but there's a little bit of a sigh of relief that, well, the Secretary of State, even though he's a businessman, at least he's a businessman and not straight out of the American Enterprise Institute and some kind of neoconservative ideologue, and yet coming from Exxon, that means he might as well not even be a Texan. He might as well be from Saudi. People say, oh, he's friends with Putin. Forget Putin. He's friends with the king of Saudi Arabia, who he's really friends with. And that just means that if there's, you know, anyone hoping we might have some kind of break from Obama's policy here, you know, there's no real reason to think that we're going to see it. And he's already come out, right? As you're saying, they've gone ahead and licensed what they claimed they were canceling. Hey, let me ask you one thing, because I know you. I just know you've paid so much close attention to Yemen here. I have two unconfirmed rumors. I'll characterize them as such, but they come from really good sources. Former Ambassador Dan Simpson heard a rumor like this. He called it a rumor, unconfirmed report. And Andrew Coburn, one of the best journalists around, also heard an unconfirmed report, but two separate unconfirmed reports, saying that there were actually American flyers, airmen, contractors, or maybe even Air Force, not sure, riding in the back seat of those Saudi F-15s, bombing the Houthis, or, you know, targets near Houthis anyway. I don't want to be too specific. I just wonder if you heard anything about that, Americans actually helping, holding hands with the Saudis all the way to their targets there.
I mean, I've heard a lot of things, but I don't know if that would be one of them. The U.S. has obviously been supporting them you could imagine them in the cockpit in a way, you know, even if they're not.
Right.
They were providing intelligence early on, it seems, more than later on. And they are meeting the Saudi jets in midair just outside of Yemeni airspace. I think that's how they have it set up. Mm-hmm. I haven't heard that specifically. And I'd want to get some better sourcing on that. But there's like a lot of U.S. contractors on the ground to begin with. I spent a long time trying to track down a total for that, you know, to kind of articulate the U.S. support in all its manifestations. Obviously, there's the refueling. There's the record bomb sales, weapon sales under Obama. There's the unit that was sent over to assist in the campaign. And then there's just the countless contractors that are on the ground anyway. So, you know, whether they're in the cockpit or, you know, sitting behind the Saudi or UAE pilot, I think the implication is already clear.
Yeah. Metaphorically, they're already there anyway. Yeah. All right. Well, listen, I really appreciate your time on the show. I hope did I miss anything important I need to ask you?
No, I mean, I would just, you know, folks should keep an eye on the rising civilian toll in both Mosul and Raqqa. You can expect, in Mosul, it's truly horrific right now. I suggest you go on Air Wars and look up some of the recent tracking they've done. And then for Raqqa, that can be expected to continue as they move towards the city itself in earnest.
Yeah, well, and once the air wars are over and the occupations begin, man, is it going to be a whole new nightmare when the Kurdish and Shiite occupation forces in Mosul are left to deal with the Sunni population there. And who knows what's going to happen. I mean, nobody's even said what their plan is for the future government of Iraqi Sunnistan at all, or Eastern Syria for that. I mean, I guess the assumption is Assad will rule Eastern Syria again, but does anybody really believe Baghdad is going to rule Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul like they had before? I don't know. I mean, I guess they're trying now, but with you know, that's an important interview I need to get, Samuel, I guess, is what is the current state of affairs in Fallujah and Ramadi right now that that they've been taken back?
The post-ISIS plan it needs to be more fully articulated, I would think. Otherwise, history, you know, could repeat itself.
Yep. All right. Well, listen, thank you very much for your great work and your time on the show. I really appreciate it.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right, y'all. That is Samuel Oakford at airwars.org, keeping track of American and other Russian and Syrian forces and their civilian casualties for you there. Airwars.org. And sign up for their email list. I'll keep you up to date on all of it. That's Scott Horton Show. Thanks, you guys. Check me out at scotthorton.org and libertarianinstitute.org/Scott Horton Show. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. Thanks.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.